welcome everyone. My name is Laurie Ciello. I'm the Director of Programs and Communications here at the Historical Society. I know many of you are already familiar with our organization, but for anyone who's here for the first time, I just wanted to let you know that the Historical Society was founded in 1824. We're one of the nation's oldest and largest archives of historic documents. We have more than 21 million documents under our roof, including many of the nation's treasures, handwritten drafts of the United States Constitution, a signed copy of the Emancipation Proclamation, and I know we have a lot of great Native American things as well. We invite you to get more involved here at HSP. Please look for us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can sign up for our email newsletter. If you've given us your email address, you'll probably be hearing from us soon. Also, you can pick up a copy of our membership newsletter, which is down at the front desk. And in here, you can see our calendar of events for, I think, up until June. We have a number of things coming up. On March 23rd, we're going to be hosting an event called The City of Brotherly Love, which is part of the Greater Philadelphia Roundtables. And on April 6th, we welcome author Tim McGrath, who will speak about his recently published book about John Barry, the father of the American Navy. This event is part of the Free Library of Philadelphia's One Book, One Philadelphia event. If you'd like to see a full listing of the events, we have these little books down at the front desk as well. And I'd like to just introduce Susan Strucker, who's here with the Free Library, and she's going to say a few words about the festival.
Hi, everyone. We're glad to see you guys out tonight. As Laurie said, we have a bunch of books downstairs if you're interested in more One Book, One Philadelphia events. Our selection this year is Sherman Alexie's War Dances and the Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. And also, if you're interested in more information, you can check out our website, freelibrary.org/onebook, or you can follow our Twitter, onebookonephila. And I think that's it. If you have any questions, you can ask me. I'll be hanging out in the back.
Thank you, Susan. We'd also like to thank the Free Library of Philadelphia for including us in their festival. Before we get started, I just would like to let you know, if you registered online, you will be receiving in the next day or two an online survey asking for your feedback. There's just 7 questions, so we'd really appreciate it if you could take the time, let us know what you thought, so we can try to have better programs and programs that interest you in the future. And now I'd like to introduce our speaker, David Vaughn, and thank him for being here with us tonight. Mr. Vaughn is a Cherokee genealogy specialist, a member of the Association of Professional Genealogists, and a member of the Cherokee National Historical Society. He's also a tribal genealogist for the Mississippi Cherokee Tribe and a member of the First Families of the Old Cherokee Nation. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Vaughn.
Okay, it's been about 20 years since I've done any type of lectures, so kind of bear with me. My skills are a bit rusty. Okay, the basic reason why we're doing this today is to kind of give you guys a hint or some push in the right direction as to how to go about finding information on your Native American ancestors. There's a lot of information out there. It's difficult to dig it out of the woodwork. Sometimes it's almost impossible to find, but it's there. Most of it's in the National Archives. Don't go over here to the National Archives group here locally in Philly unless your people were here in this area, the Northeast. They will have records on almost every Native American group that was in the Northeast of the United States from around 1700 to present day. They do not have information on Cherokees. They don't have any information on the Southern Indians or the Western Indians, only the ones that were local in this area. So they should have stuff on the Lenapes, Powhatans, the Indian groups from New York, things of that nature. But they're all regionalized. Okay, back when the white man first came to this country, it was empty. There was no one here because the King of Spain had decided that the Indians were not human. They did not have a soul. They had no rights. Consequently, the white people could do whatever they dang well pleased, and they would be protected under English, British, French, or Spanish law. First people to come here were traders. They were trying to find out what kind of natural resources were available and how to go about making the most money out of it. The Spanish came here for gold. They found a lot of it down in Mexico. the conquistadors sent a group of people from the coast of Texas diagonally across up toward Washington State looking for gold. Most of them died in the desert. But they established the boundaries for another area that was later to become New Spain.
New Spain started off here at the corner of Texas and followed a river course all the way up here until just about Washington State. Everything to the left of that was Spanish territory, including Mexico. The French took everything that the Spanish didn't claim all the way to the Mississippi River and called that New France. And of course, the British took this piece up here and called it New England. But yet they established colonies all up and down through the area here. And these colonies, when they first established them, in little tiny outposts on the strips, but the borders ran all the way to the Mississippi River. It's wide open land.
When these traders arrived, they had trade goods. We all know the story of Manhattan. Guys had a big box of beads and trinkets and basically traded away the rights to the land of Manhattan, the whole island, in exchange for these beads. The natives thought, this guy just want to hunt and fish here for a while. They're not going to live here forever. They're not going to keep it forever. There was no concept of permanent ownership, no concept of ownership of land whatsoever. We used the land as we needed to support ourselves, and that's all. Then we move on. And so you leave the land as you found it and take only what you can use, the way that they lived. When the traders arrived with all these trade goods, the Indians found out about it pretty quick. They had an Indian telegraph. They could information travel. People wanted these goods. They would swarm to the location of where the traders were set up. New Orleans was a center of activity down here for the French. The Spanish were all up and down. They didn't establish too many seaports over there in Texas, but they did have in New Mexico. The Spanish also had forts over here in Florida. And the British very quickly established it at Charlestown and up here in the Virginia area, right up along the coast in that area, as well as up in New York and the coast in Pennsylvania. Whenever the white people showed up with trade goods, the Indians started coming. They wanted to make trade. They wanted to get these goods. They thought these were the greatest thing in the world. Back in the beginning, the white men were trading guns and ammunition to the Indians for deer skins, pelts, things of that nature. Once they saw how rich the furs and the quality of the leather was from the United States, opened up a brand new market in Europe. They established the fur trade. The fur trade far outstripped the tobacco trade and the rum trade. Those are small pieces compared to what was going on with the fur trade. Fur trade led to wars all over this country. First, it was British against the French trying to outcompete each other. And then it was the French Indians attacking the British Indians and attacking the Spanish Indians to drive them away from certain areas so they could collect the furs from those areas and make even more money, get more guns, get more good trade goods. Now, the men wanted iron axes, iron knives. They wanted iron guns. What did the women want? Most important thing. What did their wives want? Needles and threads, scissors, cloth, ribbon. Ribbons were in short supply and high demand. So were scissors and needles. So they would tell their husband, okay, we've got all this furs here, I want. And she'd make up her wish list. You can get a gun if you want to, but I want all these things back too. If you haven't got enough to get a gun on top of it, then you get my stuff first. The women rule the roost. They control the families very tightly. Competition set in. Indian groups are fighting other Indian groups. You had the British Indians traded with the British. French Indians traded with the French. Spanish Indians traded with the Spanish. Some Indians decided to switch back and forth ever so often. They'd try out the French for a while, and when the French prices started going up, more furs now for a gun, they'd go over and try out the British. Well, The French guy says, this is only 10 rabbit skins for an iron knife, and you want 20? I'll go back over to them. Oh, I'll give it to you for 10, no problem. Wheeling and dealing. The smaller Indian groups that were already near these trading outposts suffered. You would think they would make out like bandits, right? But as soon as they got the trade established, the word got out, and the bigger, more powerful nations would actually move in to take control of the trade and push the little guys out. It's like having dogs of a different size coming to feed at the same time. The big dog's always going to win. Indian traders. It became apparent very quickly that the Indians were not going to come swarming down to the seacoast of the big towns to bring their goods all the time. Somebody else might intervene. Someone could rob their train, steal their goods, and cash in on it. And they may get sidetracked and go trade with the French instead of the British. How are we going to prevent that? They started commissioning Indian traders, licensed Indian traders. Each country had them, who would go out and live with the Indians. It made sure that you had a representative from your government right there in the middle of that big town who was your licensed trader. He was authorized to do an immediate exchange of whatever trade goods were available for whatever furs you had. And he had a sliding scale he could use. In order for him to establish himself very solidly with the Indian group, he had to become a member of the tribe. Fastest way to do that? Marry an Indian lady. The Indian women control the family. They control all aspects of marriage and the home life. It was the women who picked the men. And ladies that were in that group were saying, okay, well, that's a real nice looking fella, but who cares about how he looks? He's got a lot of money. He's a trader. He's got the goods. He's the rich man on the block. Status in society, typically the daughters of the chief were the ones that would push the other girls aside and take the man. Well, this was also for the guy's benefit, too, because now if he had to travel out of the area and go down to, say, Charlestown to deliver all of the furs that he had, he's going to need to have an Indian escort come along with him to protect his goods and to come back. He's got to have an armed Indian escort. You pass through a hostile territory, well, I'm married to the daughter of Chief so-and-so. It's a good pass. They let you through without a problem. That's how a lot of the English, Scottish, Irish, German names began showing up amongst Indian families. About 1700, the British set up fortifications. And all the way out here in the wild frontier, about this location right here in Tennessee, built a fort, trading post. Call it Fort Loudoun. They put about 100 British soldiers out there, all conscripts. They weren't going to be paid. But at the end of their six-year tour of duty, they would be granted a one-square-mile land grant in the area where they were doing their business around the fort. Well, if I'm going to be living here with a one-square-mile of farmland, I might as well pick me one of these ladies and start a family. And that's how the names got started. You had the Indian traders, you had the British soldiers, you had a few British merchants. You had the same thing happen with the French. The Frenchmen tended to have a circuit. They would travel a big loop, starting at, say, New Orleans and going up a certain river and coming back down with all the goods. Then they'd come back maybe once, twice a year. They had families all along that route. The women weren't as particular about marriage in those days like we are today. They would say, okay, we're going to go through a ceremony by the local priest or the medicine man, and we're going to get married, and we're going to have children. And whenever he's in town, kids get to meet their daddy again. We know he's got more work to do, and we figure he's probably got other family elsewhere, but it's not important. What's important is I have children. Okay, well, the French weren't too happy about the area where they were in. It wasn't as lucrative as they thought it was going to be. And they began trying to undercut prices for the British. And this became a problem. The French Indians intruded all the way into central Pennsylvania.
there was a, I forget the name of the town, it was around central Pennsylvania, where they actually had a fort that was built by French forces when they should have been on the other side of the Mississippi River. We don't know if these guys had come down from Quebec or if they had incurred all the way up the river from on the other side. But they had control, taking control of the Indians, they had been trading with the British. The British didn't like this a bit. So the British says, okay, we have to fight these guys. How are we going to do it? We don't have enough forces here. We can't send people up there to fight those guys, and we're barely making even by keeping our little trading post open. Somebody had a brilliant idea for the British. Let's make these guys, the head men of each neighbor, every town that we found, let's make them town kings and call them by a title, make them royalty, and treat them like royalty. So we have their loyalty, we have their support, and they can then give us warriors who will answer our orders to go and fight. That's where you had the French-Indian Wars. You had the British Indians go out and fighting the French Indians fighting the Spanish Indians, and just send the Indians out, kill a bunch of the Indians. It's no skin off our nose. Begin thinning out the Indians. All the diseases the white man brought over with them, especially communicable diseases, the fevers, the smallpox, things of this nature, dysentery, it wiped out a lot of the Indians. There are figures that, estimates, that say there's on the neighborhood of 35 million Native Americans within the confines of the United States first time when Christopher Columbus arrived. These are guesstimates. And roughly 20 years later, they figure it was less than 10% of that. Like 90% of the people had died of disease. I'm going to divert a little bit and go with primarily with the Cherokees now, because that's what I know most about. But if you have questions about other kinds of Indians, all this information kind of entails what's the whole pattern is the same. In other words, if your people were Creek, or if they were Shawnee, they were all affected by the same thing. The whites were moving in, taking more and more land every year, officially and unofficially. The government would go in and try to deal with the local Indians to make a treaty to take more land for their settlers to be able to come in and build up more farms. Quite often you would have a few screwballs here and there who would decide to strike out on their own with a half a dozen families, heavily armed men, and go off into the middle as far as they could go with their wagon before the wheels fell off, and create their own state. The state of Franklin, created in the middle of what is now Tennessee, was just that sort of a situation. The whites literally intruded, invaded, set up camp, burned the forest down, killed all the animals in them or drove them out, and started farming tobacco. Good money for those guys who could get in and get out, but Indians come back to their hunting grounds and it's gone. All the animals are gone. What are we going to do to live now? Well, they had a circuit. They would hunt certain areas in pattern, so they didn't overhunt an area, and by the time they come back to the area they had left 2 years ago, it's not there anymore. It's covered with white people. It's got cabins and whatnot everywhere. There's not a tree to be seen, and not a deer anywhere at all. They're gone. So the Indians started getting disgusted, and they began moving farther west or north or south, any way to get away from these people. Then, of course, we had the American Revolution. Of course, the British Indians, being the Cherokees, supporting those guys, were treated as Tories or supporters of the British once the war was over. Now, the Americans, the rebels who won that war, began to have a retribution against the Cherokees. Because you've been on the wrong side. You put back the wrong people during this war. They started putting pressure on them. We want more land. We want more land. We want more land. I've got a map here of some of the areas. Let's see which one comes up first. This was the original extent of the Cherokee Cherokee Nation. This was established by King George in 1710. Covered quite a bit of an area. By 1835, it covered an area right here in the corner of Tennessee, corner of North Carolina, and the northern corner of Georgia. That was all that was left.
Syracuse thought they had it made. They were negotiating. They had legislatures that were going to Pennsylvania to talk to the politicians and getting things under control. And there was a major volcanic eruption out in the Indonesian. It's happened before. It'll happen again. There was so much ash thrown up into the air that most of the world experienced a nuclear winter. There was at least one summer without a summer that went straight from winter into fall into winter. Nothing sprouted. Nothing grew. Anything that was forced to sprout died. No sun. Poor rain. It was horrible. Most of the United States was on a starvation alert. Cherokees found out about this. Well, geez, we've got lots and lots of corn and stored meat. We've got more than we can ever use. They usually grew enough to last them 7 years. Sound kind of familiar? The Mormons? Mormons caught on to this. They had corn, they had dried meat and fish to last 7 years. They began offering it to their white counterparts nearby to keep them from starving. That no good deed goes unpunished. The whites thought, we can't grow anything up here. There's no animals anywhere. They all starve to death as well, and yet all this food is coming out of the Cherokee Nation. That land must be enchanted. We want it. They pushed Congress, they pushed the representatives to force them into making a deal with the Cherokees to get all the Cherokee land away from them and give it to the whites that deserved it more. Well, 1817, the white government came in. Cherokees wanted no part of this. They got three small town mayors drunk. Got them to make their mark on a piece of paper, and they claimed that was a treaty that gave away the entire Cherokee Nation to the whites and had to be vacated within 20 years. 20 years came along. Cherokee's still there. They came in with the army, rounded them up, and force-marched them off to Oklahoma. As far back as 1775, the Indians from the Cherokee area were migrating west to get away from the whites, to get away from the disease, to get away from the trade, the drunken people, everything was wrong. The whole world was upside down, and they were just going as far away as they could to get away from this. A group of Indians established a new nation in Missouri in 1775. It's called they eventually adopt the name of the Northern Cherokee Nation. Now that lasted until about 1830, and the white men came across the river, violated the treaty. The army was on the side of the white folks because they're white folks, they vote, they pay taxes, and they kicked all the Indians out. So those that wanted to stay, they had to pretend to be white. They had to pass for white. They had to adopt white names if they didn't have them already, speak English, dress like the white men, act like the white farmers, and pretend that they belong there, or else they're going to lose everything. Cherokees had a unique connection with the slaves. They didn't own slaves. They leased them from other folks back further east in the plantations and such back in these areas here. But once they got into the Cherokee Nation, the owners couldn't come get them because the Indians wouldn't let them. Once they were there and learned the language, learned the customs, and looked that they were going to be a good citizen, they were indoctrinated into the tribe, allowed to marry, and do whatever they wanted to do. Stay nearby, go build a house someplace, take your wife and go, leave the nation, whatever you wish to do. There was one particular guy down here in the northern corner of Georgia that was actually paying these guys on the books a certain amount of money for their labor. And after 2 years of labor, he would say, okay, you got this money. I can either give it to you in gold and you can go your merry way and buy some land someplace, or I can go as your man
and go back to the plantation where your family was from and buy them away from their old owner and bring them back to you. So when it came time for the mass migration of the Cherokees in 1835, ending the removal air time, most of the black folks who had been part of this decided it would be better to be a, quote, Cherokee slave than be free in a white man's world. And they went with them. They walked the Trail of Tears. There were thousands of families, thousands of them.
One of the nice things the American government, how they treated the Indians, Andy Jackson, the guy that's on our $20 bill, was using the Creeks, which were French Indians, but bending toward support of the British, were very easy to convince to help by trade goods his efforts to kick the British out of the United States. Around 1812, they were getting word here that the war was about to start again. The British were planning another invasion. He went down and he armed the Creeks, armed them to the teeth. The Creeks went down to New Orleans to help the rebels repulse the British one last time, along with John Lafitte and his pirates. They were all part of it. They kicked the British out. Most of the Creeks were killed in the process because they were frontline troops. They were guerrilla warfare, sneaking around to the bushes and getting the guys from behind. Most of them were killed. By 1814, they were demanding their payments for all the stuff they had done. Andy Jackson made certain promises. He's going to give us a certain area. It's going to be the Creek Nation, our state, if you will, within the country. Never to be messed with again. No white man ever come in there. What did Andy do? He went over to the Cherokees, gave them a bunch of guns and whiskey and ammunition, and cranked them up against the Creeks. They're right over there across that river. Go kill them. Cherokee said, why not? Always aching for a fight. Over they went. They wiped out the Creeks. Andy Jackson took what was left of the Creeks and chained and marched them off to Oklahoma. So much for promises. Okay. Indian names. That's always a fun one. How did the Indians get English names? We talked a bit about that. They got some of it from the Indian traders, both British, Scottish, Spanish, French. Get down around New Orleans and those areas, you find a lot of Indian folks down in that area with French names. You get out here toward the Cherokee group and the Creeks and the Choctaw and the Chickasaw, and all of them have good sounding English names or Scottish names. A lot of mix and a lot of max and a lot of O's. Now, when you go looking for your ancestors in these records, just remember that most people back in those periods could not spell. Most of the country was illiterate. So you get down, the guy comes over and says, okay, what's your name? And he would try to write it down. Depending on the quality of his penmanship and what he thought he heard and what dialect it was spoken in, it might look like this. Any of you people speak with a southern accent or any other regional accent? You ever have trouble telling somebody how to spell your name over the phone? Just about every one of us had a problem like that. Another thing was most of the Indians had names that meant something to them. Someone could be called Morning Dove. It was a beautiful thing that the mother saw right shortly after they were born. It was like, okay, we'll call you Morning Dove. Deer in the water. Bear going in hole. Bear paw. Young wolf. Young pig, young dog, puppy, all sorts of birds, snakes, you name it, animals, actions. He walks the ridge. So his name is The Ridge, or Ridge Walker. So how is it written down? Not The Ridge, it's Ridge Walker. His family name is not Walker. Go figure. The way the white man did it, every sentence that he held, every treaty, you had a qualification. We're going to write, here it is, 2010, we're going to write everyone down on this thing here, but you're claiming you had ancestors who were here in Philadelphia, say, in 1990. What was your ancestor's name who lived here in 1990? Well, it was John Jones. I look on my list, I don't see a John Jones. I said, there was Jack Jones, James Jones, no John Jones. You're disqualified. The name of him is called by at home,
but not necessarily his legal name. Because how many people do you know that are named John? Quite a few. It's confusing sometimes when you're talking in a conversation, say, John. Well, John who? Indians had a way, they had smaller towns, a little more intimate, they had a way to work around this. They got too many Johns. We got three Johns already, and that's too many. We're going to call you something else, starting with the same letter of the alphabet. Instead of John, you'll be James, or Joe, or Jim, or something else. We'll figure it out. But we've given you a nickname. Now, everyone now knows you as Jim. Pretty soon, your family's going to start calling you Jim. And your grandchildren are going to write down Jim Jones. And he didn't exist on that record back there. It was a John Jones. Spelling, if you're looking for an ancestor, say his name. If they were from an area of the south of the United States, try to say it with a southern drawl or get somebody else who can speak that to say it that way. Write it down in phonetic groups where just the syllables, saying the syllables over and over, sounds like his name. And then go and look for spelling along those lines. Don't worry about double consonants. I's can be E's, can be O's. Just think about all the ways that your name has been mutilated when you talk to somebody over the phone. Then you get where you're going, and you say, what the heck is that? It happened to you in grammar school. It happened to you through high school, college. It happened to you today when you're ordering something or speaking to somebody on the phone. They use that when you're looking for ancestors. And another thing about name changes. Most American Indians had a more fluid idea about names. When you were a tiny kid, you weren't named until you were like 2 years old. They wanted to make sure you survived that long. Then a mother would give them a pet name. When they got to be 8, 9, 10 years old, they start just showing parts of their personality. And one kid, he just loves to eat. He loves to eat so much, he's right there on the edge of the fire, sticking his nose into the pot and getting all the smoke all over him all the time. So they come up with a name that's going to fit that. Cooking boy, smells like smoke, something in their language that's going to describe him specifically because of his personality trait. Then at the age of 14, he goes off to warrior camp. Or the girl goes off to women's camp, if you will, where she's taught by her female relatives everything there is to know about being a woman and a wife. The boy goes off, he goes out with one of the big warriors, fought in the last couple of wars, and they camp out and they teach him how to use weapons, how to make weapons, and they go through all the training exercises, get one group against the other, try to capture them, try to raft, all this stuff, and become a warrior. Now, you can't be going by this little nickname of, smoking boy. We're going to give you a man's name. We're going to call you Rock. Or you blunt the arrow. We're going to call you Snake because you sneak upon people. That's great. Same thing with the girls. Now the guy goes out and he's 14. Now he's got to be a man. He can go marry. If he can find a woman who will have him at that age. Most of the women waited and got a man that was like 15 or 20 years older than themselves. Established, more or less, they could see where he's going, where he's come from, and say, yeah, that's the guy I want to hook into and be my man. And they'd go and they would take him, quite literally. You ever hear of Sadie Hawkins Day? Mm-hmm. They still practice that down south in some places, and that's the way it was, women's choice. Got to go off to war, kill three enemies. He comes back, we're going to reward you with that. We are now three killer. Now, you go off to the next war. You kill two more. Now you're five killer. You go off to another little battle, and you kill a Catawba Indian. So now you're Catawba killer. So names change all the time. So if you get a new nickname of Jim instead of John, what's the big deal? So I'm Jim now. That's no big thing. I think they did it on purpose. To mess with us, future generations, to try to find him. Sometimes it feels like that. One thing about genealogy, it's a never-ending chore. Once you start, you can't stop. set yourself a goal. I'm going to go as far back as my great-great-great-grandparents and no more. And stick to it. Because every door you open leaves a couple more doors that are not left behind. And you get curious. Well, I got this far. Anybody know what a football widow is? Football season, basketball widow, same thing. Sports widow, as soon as that season starts, the old man stuck right in front of the TV, and he doesn't exist except in front of that TV. My wife calls me a genealogy widow. I get on the computer. It knows no season. It's year-round. Anything happen, I'm in the middle of the thing doing some kind of genealogy, trying to help somebody out, trying to help get somebody in the right direction, or digging through the records myself to try to find him. It's not pretty. Most of you people have heard about the Trail of Tears. It's kind of a common thing. Was that a single event that occurred once along one particular path? No. It occurred in 1775. 1810, 1817 through 1835, and in 1837. There were at least seven different routes. Some were fairly straightforward, others, the worst one, winter of 1837, they took the Cherokee Indians from here in October, marched them north to the headwaters of the Mississippi, crossed the frozen headwaters of the Mississippi, marched them south until they got south of the Missouri River. They didn't have any shoes. They had to leave everything in their cabin when they were set upon by the soldiers. Anybody who tried to go back into the cabin to get anything was shot. They didn't have blankets. They had their summer clothes on when they were rounded up. The money and the clothing and whatnot that was allotted eventually by the government to help these people out while they were in stockades, prison camps, was typically taken and sold in the black market by the soldiers, along with all their food. So they were malnourished to begin with, poorly equipped, and they were forced marched up to the worst part of the United States in the dead of winter. It was one of the worst winters on record as well. 16,000 people started that walk, 4,000 died. Frozen to death, starvation, disease. Couldn't bury them, the ground was too hard. And just leaving the South Trail. Other groups were taken by riverboat up the various rivers. The Ohio River was a popular one, down to the Mississippi, and then down into a little river going up into Arkansas territory. Some were taken all the way down to the Red River and sent up into the Oklahoma area. At the time, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Missouri, anything south of the Missouri River was new Indian territory for the Cherokee Indian Nation. Didn't last long. Pretty soon the white guys could come across the river and say, oh, this land over here in Missouri is better than what I had back over there in Tennessee, or better than what I had in Kentucky. And they just settled down and start plowing and planting. And they had the soldiers going to support them and keep the Indians off their back. All the Indians could do was complain. When they complained, the Indians got moved. The Trail of Tears, as the historical movement, occurred the winter of 1837, 1838. That's the trail where so many people starved to death along the way. Prior to that, all the previous trails were all voluntary. You took your family or family groups, could be thousands of people or as few as one person. They gave you a handwritten map of how to walk that route. They had blazed the trail just by marking some of the trees along the way. Gave you rations for 6 months. Gave you a gun, some ammunition, blankets, pots and pans. Or you had a choice from a list. Pick your kit. They gave you a horse. Go west. Once you were out of Tennessee and Georgia, they didn't care where you went. They had a mandate to get the Indians out of Tennessee and Georgia. Didn't help the Indians down in Georgia much, because right about that time they had discovered gold in the Indian nation. The Indians found gold. And of course, you brought all the guys from Georgia going in there and trying to mine the gold and take what they could, or going and beating up on some of the local Indian families down there. You must have some gold. And if you don't have any gold, then we're going to take your horse and your pigs and your cattle and butcher them and eat them ourselves, just because you didn't give us any gold. 1837, 1838, the people wound up going to northern area of New Indian Territory at that time. Missouri was no longer available. Most of Arkansas was no longer available. They were originally part of the treaty. Oklahoma, the south end of Kansas, the northern end of Texas, East Texas, and the border area of the corner of Missouri, border area of Arkansas, were still part of the Indian Territory at that time. They didn't count these people again until 1850. You know, 20 years. Well, 10 years, sorry. And they finally went in and did an actual count. All those who went before the Trail of Tears had one political division. They were put on one roll. They were paid for all the Indian land they had lost, at to the order of $270 per person in gold. The people who were on the Trail of Tears, there were too many of them. Government couldn't put it in the budget, couldn't fund it. So they just said, okay, we'll just give you some food and enough material to build some houses, and we'll get around to you next year. Well, next year never came, until 1900, 50 years later. He says, by now, these guys have multiplied like rabbits. We couldn't possibly give them that much money right now. What are we going to do? Give them some of their own land, make it into a farm. They counted up the number of families that were in the area. They said, okay, if we divide this area by this number of families, giving each family a square mile, all this territory up and through here, all the way up into Kansas and into Colorado, this whole area, we can reduce that down to about four or five counties in the corner of Oklahoma. And all the rest of the land becomes surplus federal lands. What are you going to do with all that land? You know, the Rockefellers and some of the other big, rich families up in the Northeast, the lumber barons, they had political connections. Connecting with Congress, they said, okay, we will buy that land for pennies on the dollar. And they turn around and we can sell it to settlers, can sell it to railroad rights, we can sell water rights. And around that time, people were coming up with the idea of, hey, oil, not for burning in cars, but to replace whale oil as a means for having lights at home. The old whale oil lamps turned into regular kerosene or oil lamps at the time. All kinds of exports that was used for the land. Who made the money? Indians? Oh yeah. They took 250 million acres and wound up giving them the couple of counties of basically dry barren land to live on. Land for land. Between 1850 and 1880, the gold rush was on in this country. Of course, they had miners of 49ers going out to California. No, Indians were affected by that too. A lot of them packed up and headed out Pikes Peak, Colorado, all the way out to the Rocky Mountains, go out and become gold miners, silver miners, see if we can go strike it rich. Some of them did, and they stayed. There are Cherokee settlements all the way into Washington State, Oregon, Northern California, and Colorado to this day from the Cherokee Argonauts. The other tribes are also represented in there, but not as many. The reason we talk about the Cherokee is because we have more records on them. They say the Cherokees right now are the largest Native American nation in the United States, with over 500,000 members. 500,000 registered members who had ancestors on the Dawes Roll and can prove it. Funny thing is, when the Dawes Roll came, it was to give land for all those people from the Trail of Tears who had not been paid like the earlier settlers had, so the earlier settlers were excluded from the Dawes Roll. All those Indians who had left the Indian Nation and gone elsewhere, gone into Alabama, into Florida, into the Carolinas, gone north, gone to Ohio, Indiana, or drifted all the way out to Oregon, they weren't included either. You had to have been living in Oklahoma within what they call New Indian Territory from 1850 continuously to 1900 in order to be on the Dawes Roll and a descendant of someone from the Trail of Tears. So all the rest of the Indians, including the Cherokees who were there for earlier and those that went elsewhere, not included. A lot of those people got upset and said, well, you gave all this land to the guys down here in Oklahoma who had been here. What about the rest of us who didn't go to Oklahoma? You took our land as well. We want some justice. Number of Cherokees got together. They had a number of people who were lawyers, who were statesmen, who were politicians. They sued the federal government over this, and they won. You can't sue the federal government unless they agree to let you sue them. That's number one. They were very convincing. They sued them, they won, and the government commissioned a fellow by the name of Guyon Miller to go out and take a roll, a listing of all these Cherokees who are out there all over the United States. How are you going to do that? One guy on a horse, buggy, chasing around all over the country? No. Put up posters in every post office, in every town, and word of mouth took the information elsewhere. They started in 1905. It says, if you have Cherokee ancestry and you want to get some money out of the government, there's $1 million pot has been allotted for this. You want some of that money, fill out this form, and we'll see about getting you some of your money. I'm sure you guys have probably had these flyers come in the mail about these class action lawsuits, something along the same lines. You may never see a penny of that. Don't count on it. They expected to have something on the order of 30,000 families file applications. There were over 90,000 families who filed applications, and the reason there weren't more is because the word had gotten out that if you go and you file this application, you're putting down your name, you're putting down the town you live in. Those guys are going to come and arrest you for violating the anti-Indian laws and going to haul you off to a reservation and take everything you own. They thought it was a government scam. So 90% of the people refused to sign up. Government estimated there were somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 million Cherokee families in the United States in 1905, 1906 time frame. Most of them didn't sign up. They didn't put down their genealogical information, so it didn't get recorded. People who did sign up, though, they were asked, okay, we need information on you. We need your name, your date and place of birth. Yeah, year. You probably don't know what date it was anyway, because most of them didn't follow the white man's calendar. State of birth and what year it was in. Now, I want the same information on your wife once we're finished, but now we got you. I want to know about all your children. Where and when were they born? How old are they? All your siblings. Not only where and when were they born, but where are they now? Where are they living? Who did they marry? Your parents. Everything about them. Where they came from. How are your parents or your grandparents connected to the old Cherokee Nation? Put everything down in black and white on this form. If it doesn't fit the form, write me a letter explaining in detail how your family's connected. If you got a famous aunt, uncle, or cousin who's that you know that they know is Cherokee, put them down. I'm a cousin of Will Rogers. Put all that information down there so they can try to connect the dots. There were so many people who made the application that the government says, we're going to have to start putting some limits on this and cut things off because we don't have enough money to give them anything at all. Even with the 35,000 people that actually got approved, they wound up getting about $35 per person out of that $1 million fund. The fund was mismanaged. A lot of the money was siphoned off. Some of the money went to pay people for their work around on the Miller Roll and collecting data and whatnot. By the time it got down to the individuals, about $35 anything a family would receive. Which back in that time was about 6 months worth of wage for a farmer. Some people were really counting on that money and never got it. Fortunately, all that information is in the National Archives. You find an ancestor or any kind of a family relative at all on the Miller Roll, you can get all the family information, the complete family history back for at least four generations with all the connections to the Cherokee Nation. the government says, we can't give you this money unless your people were, in fact, a party to specific treaties. And we have them on that list, the treaty list, by that name that you gave us. It was the way that they weeded them out. There were only two treaties that were actually used as qualifiers for the Miller Roll. That was the Drennan Roll of Oklahoma in 1850, which was the Trail of Tears survivors, and the Chapman Roll of North Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, which was from the original 1817 treaty, where they said either you leave the area or you become an American citizen and we give you a couple acres of land to live on. Which in 1848, they rescinded that treaty, kicked all the Indians off the land that had given to them in perpetuity. As long as the grass may grow, as long as the sun may shine, rivers may flow. Sun didn't come up today, grass stopped growing, the river was shut off. You're out of here. We're going to sell that land to the highest bidder. Fortunately, the Dawes Roll has enough information on it that you can do genealogy with it. I've got a Dawes Roll CD in my little carry pack there. A number of years back, the government put out a contract for people to give them bids on going through the Dawes Roll, which was stacks of documents about what you see in this room here in these boxes, to try to put them in some kind of order that could be used by a normal human. It was kind of like going to the Social Security Administration and saying, okay, I want a listing of everyone's Social Security number, and they give it to you in numerical form, which is good if you're a bean counter and you're looking up a particular number to see if somebody qualifies. But if you say, well, I'm with John Jones who lived in Little Rock, Arkansas, sorry, we can't help you. Our system isn't set up that way. Well, the government sent me all the information. Sent it to me with the entry data, what you throw stuff they used to call punch cards. And we just a stack of documents about this thick, with line items of all the information on each line for each person. Wife and I took a look at it and figured what we're going to have for computer equipment and for software and this sort of thing, and we sent our bid into the federal government. It's going to be really inexpensive because I wanted to do it. They came back and said, sorry, folks, we had to pull the plug on this. Budget didn't cover it. It's not funded. So you can keep the information we sent you. I wanted to do it bad enough. Wife and I sat down, spare time, after work, minimum of 2 hours a day per person, 3 years.